Hi there, I'm Lily. Welcome to the Vital Horse Podcast. I'm a veterinary surgeon passionate about what our animals' behaviour can alert us to. I focus on nurturing the innate nature of animals to address the deep roots of health, well-being and vitality. Our relationship with our horses is an inextricable part of this. I am guided by what they show me. Many people say, if only they could talk, but they can tell us so much and we can communicate back. This podcast is about you being able to help your horse fully by finding out what's going on, deciding how best to help, and then doing this ethically and effectively. In this way, we can investigate and treat behavioural signs and underlying health problems, pain, or dysfunction in our horses while actually improving our relationship with them. Let's find out how. Hi there. Welcome to my first podcast episode. And I am calling this podcast the Vital Horse Podcast. I'm going to explain the name of my business, which is Nurturing Nature Equine, in this podcast episode. And I'll also explain why I've called this podcast the Vital Horse. So really, that is because I would like to think of health as more than just the absence of disease. So there are various definitions of vitality. For example, the state of being strong and active, having energy and strength, exuberant physical strength or mental vigour, a lively and animated character, the power or ability to live, grow and develop. And I love that as being something that we should aim for in our horses and ourselves, hopefully as well, as opposed to just the prevention of disease or injury or illness. So as a vet, I'll give you a little bit of background. I've qualified in 2016, and I then worked in general mixed practice for about 7 or 8 years before some very special horses actually made me change my direction and start to delve into what I'm doing now. And what it is that I am doing now is helping animal owners, and this is mainly focused on horses, to advocate really, truly and fully for their animals in cases where they are concerned that there might be an underlying health condition or pain which is causing their horse's behavioural signs. And there may be cases where people have had quite an extensive diagnostic workup through vets, or they haven't yet started investigating for a possible physical cause, or they have a diagnosis and they are following a treatment plan, but things are still not as they should be. And in my discovery of, my sort of journey of trying to figure this out, I've gone down a fair few different avenues. And so today in this episode, I'm going to explain my sort of thought framework for how I approach this as a vet and as a trainer, and really as a lifelong student of the horse. So my journey with horses started when I was 6 years old, and I grew up in the town, and I'm not from a wealthy family or anything, so my first experiences of horses the first time I sat on a horse was actually on a Shire horse on holiday in Wales. And I went on something like a 20 minute ride around some country lanes on this enormous Shire horse. And I was just absolutely in heaven, looking at the views over the top of hedgerows and hearing her breathing and smelling her. And it was just wonderful. From then, I spent the next 5 years trying to do as much as possible with horses in riding schools, but mostly I was presented with a already tacked up horse, and said horse or pony was removed from me at the end of the riding lesson. And what I really, really wanted to do was just to spend time with the horses. When I was 11 years old, a friend of my dad's made it possible for me to have a pony on loan. I think it was 4 days a week. And I would go to the stables and spend all day, totally forget about eating. Absolutely love all of the chores, all the way to mucking out and sweeping the yard and everything. And I used to disappear for hours into the countryside on my pony with my dog and come back a lot later, having had a wonderful time. I knew from when I was about 6 years old that I wanted to be a vet when I was older. And I think that was because that was the only thing I could really think of, which meant that I would spend all of my time with animals. Also, when I got to secondary school, I absolutely loved the science subjects, so it seemed like a good fit. I did weeks and weeks of work experience in order for my application to vet school to have a chance of being successful, because it's very, very competitive to get into vet school. And I did my application, incredibly nerve-wracking time, and went for some interviews. And I was accepted at the Royal Veterinary College in London, and I spent 6 years there. So I did the veterinary program, and then I also did an intercalated degree, which is another Bachelor of Science degree, and that was sandwiched for a year in between the first half, the preclinical part of the veterinary program, and the clinical part of the veterinary program, because I thought that I might want to go into research because I was really, really getting interested in science. So I did this intercalated year to see whether I did indeed want to go into research when I'd finished my studies. And always good to try things out, because I realised that that is definitely not what I wanted to do. I didn't want to spend my time in a laboratory, although I did very much enjoy field-based research. Going out and collecting data from live animals, and especially I did some ecological surveys. I worked, did a voluntary programme at the Institute of Zoology at London Zoo the year before I went to vet school. And that was on wildlife health. And I loved that form of research. During my intercalated year, I studied comparative animal locomotion and advanced skeletal pathology alongside wild animal biology. So a strange mix. And I did my dissertation on the size and shape of long bones in semi-aquatic tetrapods. So, how do their bones? The shape of their bones and the bony projections that are muscle attachments relate to how they swim and move on land. Now, all of this was setting me up to be extremely interested in locomotion, animal locomotion, and biomechanics. When I got into my clinical years, I realised that I loved that too. So, treating animals that were unwell, whether that was medical or surgical, and I did much prefer the medical side of things at that time. When I graduated from vet school, I went into mixed practice, and everything was very overwhelming at the start. And it's just a question, really, of your proper learning as a vet starting after you've graduated. You have all of the theory, but really, all the learning is about to begin. I was all consumed by that for several years, and really didn't realize that I was practicing veterinary medicine in a way where I was becoming very skilled at what I was doing, but something really felt like it was missing. I bought a yearling horse in, it must be 2020 that I bought him, and his name is Sunny. And you may know him if you follow my social media. And he features on my website and the photo that I tend to use at the beginning of my presentations. And he really is the reason for nurturing nature equine. So when I first brought him home as a yearling, I found that it was very difficult for me to do anything with him. And I had two horses already. I had Bo, who I had had since 15 years old, who was a very traumatized rescue case, and he had taught me so much about listening to horses and responding to their behavior. And I'd built up a very deep bed of trust with him. And I had my dear old Peps, who I lost last April, who had been his field companion and had become my riding horse when I graduated from vet school. When I added Sunny to the herd, I was not expecting the challenges that I was about to face. And I found that without the history that I had with my other two, I was finding it very difficult to do anything with him. What I didn't realize for the first few months was that this was about to take me on a bit of a personal discovery journey and bring me back to rediscovering myself, really, and my passion, which is this interplay of the emotional and the physical in health and dealing with animals as individual souls as opposed to a conveyor belt of patients, which is, I was starting to get a bit fatigued in my veterinary job at that time because that's what it felt like. So Sunny brought up some difficulties that I felt like I couldn't handle. And one of those things was needle shyness. And other things were just to do with general handling, really. And what I had noticed is that when I went to see the horses in the paddock, Sonny would act as though he was a kid in a class who was a bit scared of the teacher and was doing a, oh, please don't pick me, with his expressions and pretending to busy himself with having a scratch or a very, very important patch of grass. And that hurt. I didn't want to have that kind of relationship. And I started to realize that my conveyor belt of patience in my job had meant that I was a very efficient practitioner in general practice, getting through my long lists of patients that I needed to get through, and I was good at that. But it was starting to eat away at me, and it didn't feel true to my values. So fast forward, and I have met some amazing mentors. I've traveled all over the place to work with very many amazing horsemen and women. And I have discovered this real interplay between I a little bit inwardly cringe at sort of dividing these things, but the emotional, the physical, and the mental side of living beings and how all of these things affect each other. Really, my passion lies in our relationships with our animals. So I am a vet, but my real passion lies in just this amazing fact that we can have this cross-species communication. And then, of course, I'm concerned for their well-being, and I love my job as well. And so this fusion means that I look at health and well-being from this unique lens of a vet, but really, I kind of just want to spend time with my horses. So what's in a name? The other part of my journey has been that I've always been interested in the conservation piece and hence the wild animal biology choice and working at the Institute of Zoology. And also I did a part of a master's through the University of Edinburgh, distance learning, towards the end of my time in mixed practice. And that was on biodiversity and ecosystem health. So the reason why I chose the name Nurturing Nature Equine is because I was recognizing the importance of ecosystems on many, many scales. The horse within the ecosystem and the way that they graze and browse and trample on the land and move through it and interact with different species, and the ecosystem within the horse, things like their gut microbiome and how that communicates with their brain and with their emotions and with their heart, even. Then there is this inescapable dance of nature versus nurture, especially when we domesticate animals. And I struggle with this, certainly in general practice, with certain animal breeds, for example. We have done some very extreme breeding of domesticated animals. And so sometimes health is far more related to nature than it is to nurture. For example, breeding dog breeds that can't effectively breathe without surgery. Then sometimes health conditions are more related to nurture, for example, keeping a horse shut in a stable all the time. So I was recognizing this interplay between nature and nurture, and that they are not versus, they are definitely both together. And then there's this aspect of not fighting the species, but also the individual's true nature. And I will talk in a minute about this in more detail. But one of the very early lessons that Sunny taught me was that we really need to be aiming for their cooperation, not only because surely that's what we're aiming for in having them as our companions in our lives anyway, but just because it works. It works so much better than fighting them. So when you are needing to perform a veterinary intervention or a husbandry intervention or procedure, so that could just be, for example, picking out their feet, just cleaning their feet. We need to have an understanding and a communication that means that we're doing that in cooperation. So that's why it's nurturing nature equine. It's nurturing nature in terms of the ecological side of horse keeping and how much we cannot escape that we are all part of ecosystems. And we are all ecosystems. There's ecosystems on many scales. And we need to work with that for vitality. And then there's the fact that there is nature and nurture in that affects everything on all levels that we do. And then making sure that we are nurturing their true nature, whether that's species level and in or individual level, and it should be both. So I have identified that my approach now includes three pillars and four deep roots to health and well-being. So my three pillars are, the first one is called attuned assessment. And this is where I discovered that by showing an animal that you are aware of the subtle signs that they are giving you, you can get so much more out of a physical examination than you would otherwise if you just followed a mechanical process. Animals definitely will show you where they hurt and how they feel. There is a really strong link between health conditions and behavioural obstacles that we might come up with in our animal companions and deep, meaningful relationships with them. And part of this link really lies in reading your animal's mind, body, and emotions, and they know when you're doing that, and then you can communicate subtly yet clearly. So my aim is for prevention, investigation, and recovery of their health conditions or their behavioural signs to be a journey that you take together, and you can keep you and your horse can keep communicating about it the whole way through. So when you follow this approach, you can hear your horse tell you how they feel, where they hurt, even things like how they best learn, which senses are really meaningful for them, maybe which ones they can't use as well, which senses really worry them, what sorts of situations really worry them, and really what they need. So whether that's what they need from their lifestyle, what they need from you communicating with them, what they need maybe in terms of pain relief, So lots of people say if only they could talk, but they really can. They are communicating with us all of the time. It is down to us to recognize that and to try to listen as much as we can. So attuned assessment is my way of building both a broader and a more in-depth picture of the signs that an animal is showing. And it really is the two-way communication which is at the heart of that. So the animal is an active participant in the process. This means that we can often notice a lot more than we otherwise would, and that can be really helpful for you as an owner in then communicating that to the professional that you are calling out to help you uncover what's going on, and maybe to figure out which professional it is that you need to call out. Is it a vet or is it a body worker? Is it a farrier or a foot trimmer? Is it a saddle fitter? Is it a trainer? So that's attuned assessment. The next stage in my process. So, attuned assessment is really for the investigation of a problem. So, if you are concerned that your horse has a health condition, you're concerned maybe they're injured, they have pain somewhere, or you're wondering whether a behavior that they're displaying is related to something going on in their body, which often it either is, or at least it has reflections in their body, and things can get stuck in their body, and therefore it becomes something that's going on in their body. So the second stage, the second pillar of my approach, I call wholehearted decision making. And that's where we use the information that we found to make decisions that are really serving the animal as well as the people involved. So it's not about convenience, for example. There will be practical considerations to make sure that we can actually achieve what we are deciding to do. So, for example, if your horse is highly needle phobic, wholehearted decision making will involve not prescribing or the owner explaining that they cannot follow a course of injectable medication, for example. It also involves delving into your own mindset and figuring out maybe where there might be blocks to deciding on certain courses of action. So, are you making decisions because of what will actually nurture your horse's nature the most? Or is it for a different reason? All of these things can really impact on their health and well-being long term, and yours as well. The third pillar I call compassionate implementation, and that is where the decisions that we make, we have to put them into action in a way that is both ethical and effective. And where this has really come out is where I've done a deep dive into what's called cooperative care. So this is where we train sequences of behavior to an animal that allow us to carry out veterinary or husbandry procedures with their cooperation. And there is some debate over whether the word consent is the right word to use, but certainly they have agency and choice and a voice in the process, and that builds a lot of trust. And usually they are a willing participant, whether or not that's true consent. And they have the ability to communicate to you if they are worried about the process. So I've developed this most comprehensively in terms of in terms of educating people in needle shyness, because I run an online course on needle shyness. And also, I find foot handling to be an excellent indicator of what's going on for them mentally, emotionally, and particularly physically as well. For example, problems with handling their feet can be because they have long-term abnormal posture, and they don't have very good balance, or they have weakness, or they have pain somewhere in their body. So all of this really is a cycle. These three pillars are not isolated from each other, because in your compassionate implementation, you will notice things if you are remaining attuned, which feed into attuned assessment and will let you have a better idea of what is going on for them. That then leads to your wholehearted decision making about how to compassionately implement your next step. I've also identified four deep roots to health and well-being. So this is just my thought framework on things. I tend to find there's a lot of overlap between these four deep roots, but I tend to find that if you can identify where we need to focus our energy on for now, that's a really helpful thing to do. So the first deep root I call husbandry for happiness. And this is all to do with lifestyle and our husbandry procedures. So there's a lot in this. Their lifestyle includes turnout or stabling, level of confinement, company, so horse and human company. How consistent that is, does it change all the time? Is it restful? Is it stressful? Is it enriching? That goes for other aspects of their environment. Can they move enough? Can they explore? Do they have the ability to exercise their brain? Can they exercise at liberty or are they always guided? Can they leave their, even if they have 24/7 turnout, do they have guided exercise outside of that where they can get a bit more stimulation? What is their general emotional state? What does their lifestyle, what sort of emotional state does their lifestyle put them in? Can they play? Can they rest? Can they sleep? Do they spend a lot of time traveling? Do they go to a lot of competitions and have stays away from home? What sort of security do they have? Are they very nomadic? Do they keep moving around? Which actually can be absolutely fine for horses because naturally they are nomadic. But do they have some kind of security in a group that they can return to and decompress? So really that's a social group. What sort of husbandry procedures or interventions happen? So what happens about feeding? What is their diet? How is it delivered? Not just what are the ingredients? That's also important. So for example, things like the type of hay feeders or hay nets or lack of can change their dental wear, can change their posture, their habitual feeding stance, their foot balance. What happens about worming? Are they on long-term medications? What happens about their foot care? Are they shod? Are they trimmed? Hoof boots, foot hygiene, that kind of thing. What terrain do they live on? What about gear that they wear? Are they always in some kind of gear, or are they sometimes not wearing anything? Does their gear fit? Do they have rugs that affect their posture and movement? And saddle fit comes in here as well, but it is also related to two of the other deep roots. So that is husbandry for happiness. That's their lifestyle and that's their husbandry procedures. The second pillar I call movement medicine. So this really is how much movement can they do? Is that at liberty or is that always dictated to them by a human being? What is the quality of their movement? And the nature of their movement. So it's important to consider their resting posture and their moving posture, and whether that means that they are able to rest and heal from injuries, and whether it means that they are likely to be predisposed to injuries. So the way that they stand and the way that they move. How does their rider or their handler interaction affect that? Does their rider Is their rider able to absorb and synchronize with their movement? Is their handler able to synchronize with their movement? How does that affect their biomechanics, their body posture, and their musculoskeletal development? Saddle fit plays a big role in movement medicine. And it crosses over into the third, which I call cultivating comfort. So I've done a deep dive into pain physiology on this journey. And certainly the attunement piece and horses being able to communicate to us how they're feeling ties in with us being able to identify and address pain. And healing and resting, and whether they're able to learn and retain information, whether they're able to play, whether they're able to sleep. If they have physical discomfort or if they have emotional or mental unease, it's not healthy long term. So cultivating comfort is so important for their overall health and well-being. And sometimes we have to look at this one when we have a diagnosis where we don't know whether we can actually cure it, we might have to manage it. So are we looking at alleviating pain or are we looking at actually eliminating pain? And we have to have the debate as well, what level of pain is ethical for them to be in? And then the fourth pillar is, I call it communication, compassion, and consent. And this is the relationship piece. And this affects horses and it affects us. All of this affects both of us, of course. But this really has some really deep running effects through to everything else. If horses don't experience these kinds of relationships that allow for communication and the possibility of approaching consent, and we don't have the compassion piece in there, then I really do think that it affects them. And coming back round to the reason why I have called it the Vital Horse podcast is because I think that this is what we should be aiming for. So some of the definitions again, exuberant physical strength or mental vigor. When we think of the nature of a horse, do we think of one that is standing abjectly in its stable, confined inside all the time? Or do we think of a being of this raw power that this is why we love them, right? The state of being strong and active, or just energy and strength, and the power or ability to live, grow, and develop. And this is what surely what we want to do by spending time with our horses. So if we are in a relationship state where maybe our horse is not engaged, they might be in a state of learned helplessness, they might be in a state of fear all the time, or they might be in a state of boredom, then this needs remedying for more than just that reason, and for the long-term health benefits that it provides. So this is going to form a framework for the podcast episodes as well. I will have some guest speakers that can shed more light on this subject. I'll be sharing with you how I have done a deep dive into all of these different areas. And if you are experiencing a problem with your horse where you don't know whether it might be an underlying health condition, you don't know whether there might be pain underlying a behavior, or you don't know how to communicate to your horse to alleviate these things, then you'll find some useful information on here, in that regard. And we're going to start on the with the next episode that's coming out. We're going to continue with horse happiness feeding into horse health. And after that, because my Needle Shyness online course is starting up live on the 1st of January, I'm going to go into that subject in some depth in the following episodes, and then we will come back around again to looking at these four deep roots. So thanks for listening, and I will see you in the next episode. Thanks for listening to the Vital Horse podcast, where you can find discussions focused on helping horses in ways that combine scientific principles and evidence with compassion and understanding. Do subscribe if this content has rung true for you. To work with me in a way that honours both head and heart, check out my online and in-person offerings at www.nurturingnatureequine.co.uk. If you are facing problems or are trying to answer questions with your horse, remember that physical, mental, and emotional well-being are inextricably interconnected, that there is a wisdom to nature and to the body that we can assist, and that cultivating meaningful relationships with our animal companions holds an important key to the well-being of all of us. Deep awareness and a compassionate process will enable us to find sustainable, ethical solutions. See you for the next episode, and look forward to working with you too.